You're listening to a Wheeler Centre podcast.
Novels are not so much about what happens as much as they are about the consequence of what happens.
Welcome back to the Wheeler Centre podcast. In this episode, you'll hear from American author and literary great Richard Ford, reflecting on his exceptional career with journalist Jonathan Green. Ford examines his most famous protagonist, the iconic Frank Bascom, and considers the unmissable final chapter of the series, Be Mine.
How entirely delightful.
And thank you for coming.
Thank you all for coming. A conversation with Richard Ford will ensue. But before we begin, I'd like to pay my respects and acknowledgement to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose traditional lands these are, and pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to any Indigenous Australians who may be with us in the audience this evening. We will have a conversation. Richard?
Yes.
Thank you. We will have a conversation. There will be a space afterwards for some of your questions. And I feel like a lot of my adult life has been leading to this moment.
Well, how disappointing.
I know. It's not a crushing blow. But and that may well be the case for some of you there. Let's breeze through the biography. Richard Ford, he has published 8 novels, 4 collections of stories. 5 of those novels feature the life and times of his enduring everyman, Frank Bascom. 1995 book Independence Day, it's the second of the Bascom novels after The Sports Writer in 1986. It won the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. First time anyone's pulled off that double.
It's happened again, though. Oh. Other people have done it, so it... Good.
Still good. Let me be frank with you. Shortlisted for the Pulitzer. Most recent book is the 5th Bascom novel, Be Mine. I wanted to start this with a joke, but I kind of failed to get anywhere apart from the actual setup, all right? So you might be able to help me. My setup is this. Nathan Zuckerman, Rabbit Angstrom and Frank Bascom walk into a bar. I don't know what happens after that, but...
Why the long face?
Possibly. It's perhaps the worst episode of Cheers ever filmed. I don't know. Bascom is in that interesting literary company.
Well, I'm sure that if Updike and Roth hadn't written those 2, you know, wonderful, massive collections of stories, it wouldn't have occurred to me to do it. I mean, or it wouldn't have occurred to me that such a thing could happen. And as it was, I resisted it and only really backed into it at the time I wrote the second one. But I fortunately, you know, if you live long enough, you get to meet your heroes. I was able to tell Updike at some point that, you know, thank you for writing those books because they gave me a sense of something that I thought maybe I could do.
Rabbit, of course, the final one is post death.
Yes, Rabbit at Rest. But there's also actually a little novella that he did, which I can't think of the title of, but it's a wonderful little book. He could, you know, as and I guess I could if I lived long enough, you can just go on writing those books if you have the access to the voice and if you have the material.
So how did you meet Frank Bascom?
Well, complicatedly, I had written 2 novels and nobody had read them. And so I, to truncate this, I decided I would try to write one more, and I decided I would make it be about this man who was a sports writer, and I was living in New Jersey, and the thing about the other 2 books that I thought hadn't worked very well, or hadn't worked well enough to attract readers, was that they didn't contain all I could do. That they didn't contain all that I knew, and more importantly, that they were not funny enough and not serious enough at the same time. because I sort of nascently believed that great literature is something that is both can be both funny and serious at the same time. If you think about the two masks of drama, there's a wonderful line of Henry James in which he writes at the beginning of his little book called What Maisie Knew, that there are no themes so really important as those that show the connection between bliss and bale, between the things that help and the things that hurt. And I thought, that's what I have to do. I have to write a novel that has both bliss and bale in it. And Frank Bascom was the really originated in that impulse.
Was he always Frank?
Oh, God, no. He wasn't always Frank. I set the sports writer on the bias of Jonathan Slocum's book, Sailing Alone Around the World.
Well, tell us about that, because that seems improbable.
Well, you know, no, it wasn't about anybody sailing alone around the world, that's for sure. But it was about somebody who was sailing alone in a figurative sense. And so the whole time I was writing that book, I called him Slocum. I called him, his last name, B. Slocum. I thought that was buried enough. Nobody would catch me out on it. And I had a teacher named Donald Hall, and he read it, and he said, well, this is a good book. He said, but you can't call him Slocum, because that's the name of Joe Heller's character in Something Happened. I thought, oh, shit. You know? So I had to go, when the book was finished, really, in a kind of a name search. And what I typically do when I look for words is I try to find a word that has, what is that, a troche or an iamb? Slocum. That's a troche. I wanted to have a name that was trochaic. And I like that bounce in the troche. So I look for words that had two syllables. And Bascom came up because I had a guy that I went to high school with in Little Rock whose name was Frank Baucom Newell. And I couldn't say Baucom. This is what Henry James calls the back room of the writers. But so I put an S in it and put an S into Baucom and called him Frank Bascom.
Did he emerge?
It's really a disappointing story, I realize.
I think it just happens
to be true.
I think it's a great story. Did he sort of emerge fully formed in terms of character? And I mean, is character the right word to use?
Well, I mean, he is a character as opposed to being a human being on the page. Mm. He is certainly that. He is an instrument made of language, which is what he is to me. As long as I can keep him as an instrument made of language, I can mutate him almost indefinitely, so that his character evolves in that way. I never see the characters that I write as being fully formed people, whereas I want readers to read them as fully formed people if I can be good enough.
He has, I mean, through the books, there's this sense of when you come to a new book, it's that sense that you have of re-meeting an intimate friend and someone that you had some past with, that there's been a gap, and yet there is an instant reconnection, that so much of that stuff is still in common between you, and you managed to sustain that over decades.
Yeah. Well, that's the job.
is that a really difficult work of sort of literary continuity? Do you have a Bascom spreadsheet somewhere?
No.
It's Book of Bascom?
Of all of the things that might be... Well, there's nothing hard about writing novels, frankly speaking. Monkeys can write novels, and many monkeys do write novels. But there's nothing... It's not hard. It just requires application, and it requires a belief in the possibilities of literature. And so, you know, you're getting to do what you want to do. And so in that way, it's just not hard. To regenerate Frank years later and regenerate a character who has had a life in previous books is just exactly what you think it would be, just sort of piecing it together.
So the idea of making that a connected series of books comes with Independence Day.
That's right. I thought after I finished The Sports Writer, I was a one book and out kind of guy. You write a book and that was it. And then I was thinking about writing another book, which was about a man who took his son to the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I was trying to figure out a whole matrix of character and environment and what the concerns of the book were. And it occurred to me that I had in my notes this voice which kept recurring, which was Frank's voice. And I thought, oh, well, don't do that because you're not that kind of writer. You're not that kind of an ambitious writer. And people will just say, well, you're trying to write the same book over again. And finally, after I worked on it for about a year, not writing a word, just accumulating material, I thought, well, why are you fighting this? You've got this voice that people can listen to, that people can read, that people can take pleasure in. Don't fight this. Just give in to it. And that was the way in which the possibility of writing a connected book came about.
There's a real sense there, too, of a sort of lack of belief in yourself at that point as a writer.
You bet. I mean, sometimes when I had students, sometimes students would come to me and they would say, I've lost faith in my voice. I would say, well, you just have to get in line because I lose faith in my voice all the time. I mean, that's not uncommon in the middle of a book or at any time in anyone's writing life to lose faith in what your abilities are.
What do you do to get out of that funk?
I don't think there's a formula for it. Keep on doing it. That's the one thing. I remember when I was writing Canada, I was looking forward toward a moment when I was going to introduce a character in the second half of the book. I was so looking forward to it. I'd been accumulating all this material, and I got to the point, and it just went completely dead in my hands. And I thought, oh, shit, what am I? Here I am at the moment of this book, because I can't go anywhere else. Here is this character. I have to have him here come in now, and everything I write I don't like. So I took 2 months off. I just put the book down, went away, and thought to myself, well, something maybe will happen in these 2 months that will bring me back and I'll feel more confident about being able to do it.
Are you ever wrong about that instinct, do you think? I mean, I think writers often have a sense that what I'm doing here is rubbish, but there is sufficient past experience and sufficient craft.
I have never gone past anything that I thought was bad. I like to think that if I am writing something that I think is no good, I must not push beyond that. I must take it back to the point where the red meat is. Take it back to the point where I know I was writing well, and then start forward again.
I'm interested in that pre-writing process. You talk about, you know, a year with Canada.
Yes.
Was a year with Independent. It's probably the same with all of them, of acquiring material.
Canada took me 25 years. Mm. I started writing Canada in 1988 or 89, and then something happened to derail me from really getting started writing it, and I just put it aside.
Baskin, and, perhaps?
Well, as a matter of fact, it was to write Wildlife.
Okay.
And so then I just thought, well, other Baskin books came in between, and other things came in between, and I just kept, you know, tucking away material that I would see that I thought would fit into that book, which wasn't a book, it was just a set of notes. So finally, I mean, I had one. I got around to trying to write it in the early 2000s. I think I had 35 notebooks full of stuff. So
is that full of sketch of?
It's everything. It's words that you want to, you know, you see words you want to put in a sentence. You have places that you think that you want to describe. You have the origin of that book was me thinking to myself, the story will be about a boy who gets taken across the Canadian border against his will. That's all I had. And everything kind of fitted itself into that from one direction or another. I mean, Ruskin says composition is the arrangement of unequal things. And that is what books are for me. They are an arrangement of unequal things. They are heterogeneity compelled into unity.
You say that the ligatures between events.
Right.
That's your yes. description of that process, too.
Yes. But you have to make those ligatures. Mostly they aren't there. You just have to connect them in either in a causal way or in some sense of contiguousness or whatever you can to connect those tissues.
Going back to the beginning of Bascom and the necessity of creating that vehicle for certain thoughts and ideas, tell us about those things. Microphone.
No, sorry.
Project our voice. Tell us about those things that were in the head that you wanted to express. I mean, what was his job?
Well, what was his job?
In terms of your writerly self, what did you want him to do?
that presumes I wanted him to do anything. I mean, I came back down to New Jersey where I was living, where Christina and I were living, after having lost my job as a sports writer in New York. And I had failed, I felt, to make it as a writer of the two books previous. And I came down and I said to Christina, I said, I think I'm going to try to write a novel. And she thought, well, that's good. That's what you've been doing. And she said, why don't you try to write a novel about somebody who's happy? Because I had been writing novels about darkness for its own sake being the equivalent of seriousness. And so I thought, well, that's a good idea. How do you write a serious novel about somebody who's happy? Because Tolstoy says all happy families are alike, which of course we all know they are not. So I thought I would make a character, a novel, be about somebody who had suffered a terrible, grievous injury, which is the death of his son. And was trying to find a vocabulary, and vocabulary is a crucial word here, trying to find a vocabulary about making himself happy. So that was his job, and that was my mm-hmm. job, to try to make that little premise plausible.
I wonder if it's plausible with Frank, because he glides across the surface of life. He's like that is an Emerson quote, I think, about life being skating across surfaces.
Yes.
Sort of holding your poise, but moving quickly across the space beneath you.
Well, that's interesting, Jonathan, because I would have never thought of him as sliding across life. I think he slides across some things in life, but there are many other things that I think he feels strongly about, and even grievously about sometimes, but that his whole effort is to survive those things. Mm. And I think to the extent that you do survive the death of a son, the demise of a marriage, the loss of a vocation, that you have in some ways to rise a bit above those things just to be able to see the horizon. And so I think he maybe does that.
It's the engaging thing about him. You sense that the depth of that tragedy, and yet he's not lost in it. He's not dwelling on it. He's moving to the next point.
But you know, well, that's right. But it is also because I have to have something to write. And so if I'm going to have him be in this situation, loss of a son, loss of a marriage, loss of a vocation, then I got to have something to write about that. And so the only way I can write about it is to try to find, again, a vocabulary which lets me both engage and depart from those things. I mean, novels are not so much about what happens as much as they are about the consequence of what happens. And so since I do believe that strongly, I believe it strongly in life too, but I am given a kind of a free pass to write about the consequences of these things. And to the extent that I can, I am able to let him depart from those, or at least part from them in some way.
You could have been a train driver.
And I was a train driver. I was. I was a fireman on the Missouri Pacific Railroad in Little Rock, Arkansas, when I was 17 years old. And I was telling my friend Sonia tonight that the only job I could hold was the midnight to 8, because I was so young. And so I was in these engines, these enormous diesel engines, with these old, what they called old head guys, which is to say they were old engineers. And the only job that they wanted to hold was the 12 to 8 because they were drunk.
How reassuring.
And you could hide in the yard in the middle of the night from the yard masters. And so I would be sitting over there trying my best to stay awake. And these guys, after about 4 hours, would say to me, kid, get over here and drive this thing. I would say, well, get over here and drive this thing. How do you drive this thing? And I had been watching him, of course, for all day, and been watching other old engineers. And so I just got over in the engineer's seat and ran the engine at 17. I thought it was phenomenal. And they went to sleep. And so I was running an engine in the freight yards of Poplar Bluff, Missouri, with three able-bodied switchmen on the ground. What you do when you run these yard engines is you're moving boxcars from here to there, and the switchmen are the ones who are connecting them up, and you're just pulling the boxcars out of one rail and putting them into another and doing that's what you. But and you know, it turned out I could do that.
And I think there's a great skill in it. I'm sure there is.
There isn't as much skill as you think. It's not like flying an airplane.
The Marines is another experience.
Yeah. I failed in the Marines. I just failed in the Marines. Yeah. I got sick after I had been in for a year, and I got what was called at the time acute infectious hepatitis, and got very sick. Was in the hospital for, I don't know, two and a half months, and then they busted me out. They discharged me, much to my chagrin. And then I reenlisted. As soon as I got out of the hospital, I reenlisted, and they busted me out again because my blood studies weren't perfect. And so that was the end of Vietnam for me.
There's an accumulation of experience there, though.
Well, it's an accumulation of failures is what it is. I was a teacher, too. I taught the fourth grade in Flint, Michigan, which I don't think I was very good at it, but I was smart enough to realize that I couldn't do it very well, so I quit that.
So that's an interesting chain of events. We get to that point of before the sports writer, if you're saying, and I've written these two novels, and that hasn't really worked for me either.
Right.
I mean, are you feeling that this is kind of on the edge of not panning out?
A sad story. Yeah, I felt that, but I had married the right girl, and because I had married the right girl, I didn't think anything that bad could happen, and so even if I had busted out again as a novelist after trying to write the sports writer, if it hadn't worked, I would have still been married to her, and we didn't have any kids, and we weren't broke, and we would have figured out something else to do.
You're still together all these years later.
Yeah, 60 years. Yeah, since she was 17.
That's a
and
murmur
I was 19.
Of appreciation, I think we just heard there.
Yeah. But you can't imagine what it's like, I mean, to experience those failures and to believe that it's all right. It's all right. And I generally feel that way about the failures that one goes on having in life, well, from one way or one reason or another. I just felt like I could rebound from that.
So, that sort of Bascom esque bounciness. I mean, that feels like part of you. I'm sure it is.
Maybe I'm just basically superficial at heart.
I'm not saying that.
No. But I said that. But I think there is probably a part of me that, you know, Henry James. I keep quoting Henry James, but Henry James said that to be. I mean, I know actually it was Graham Greene. He said another Greene. Said that to be a novelist, you have to have a needle of ice in your heart.
What does that do for you?
I have two.
What does that do, the ice in your heart?
Well, that's a good question. It makes you take whatever material you can find and use it. It makes you ruthless about getting something finished. It makes you perseverant about continuing on the job. All of those things and probably more.
Are you a dangerous person to have as a friend? I mean, are you the sort of writer who's likely to, you know, see your friends on the page?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I always tell my friends, if you don't want me to write about this, don't tell me. And that's just the truth. I don't do it maliciously, but I do it hungrily, and I try as much as I can to try to mask anybody's self, mask anybody's feelings. But nobody likes to think or believe that she or he is being encapsulated by somebody else. I understand that, And I don't even think it's encapsulating anybody else. I just think that sometimes I can write something and somebody I know can read it and think, oh, I know where that came from. That came from Susie, my wife, or that he, you know, so I do that. Yeah.
The bit you mentioned in Canada where you were excited about the introduction of a character down the piece a bit in the writing of the book.
Yes.
I mean, that suggests, yes, a fairly meticulous planning of that work. Then there's the thing you mentioned about Bascom's name and the rhythm of those syllables. I'm interested in writing terms of the play of those two things, the interest in that detail and the rhythm of each syllable of each sentence against the big arc of the narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, what's I'm not going to say what's the most important of those two things, because they're probably equally significant. But
they probably are.
But where's the writing work done, do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting, astute question. In the year that I spend getting ready to write a book and accumulating material and going over material and sorting it out, I just generally see where the arc of the book is going to go, which is to say, I see where spatially it starts, and I see the little lodestars along the way that I will have to pass to get to where it will spatially end. So I have that. I don't have it written down, but I have it in my brain, and then everything else is making sentences. Every other thing is choosing words. I mean, that's basically what I do as a novelist. I choose one word after another word. I don't see what I do in terms of sentences. I see what I do in terms of choosing words.
Do they arrange themselves here or here?
No, they don't. They arrange themselves on the page. If they're arranging themselves up here, I'm not aware of it. But I'm just going from one sentence to the next sentence, sometimes rather blindly. But I couldn't do that without the confidence, which is the arc that you described before, because it gives me just simply enough structure to think that wherever I am in the writing of a book is where I belong. So that will then give me the lenience to concentrate on where I think readers are most interested. What I think is that readers read, yes, for characters, yes, for, you know, locations, yes, for plots, but what they mostly care about is they care about language. They care about the words that they are experiencing. They're sitting quietly by themselves.
Does your dyslexia help with that?
It does nothing but help, because I'm so slow that I have been admitted to those non-cognitive qualities of language, which I experience reading so slowly. The syncopation in words, the sound patterns in words, how many fricatives, how many glottals, how many end stops the line. I mean, all of those kind of, we might call them poetical rather than cognitive. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that I take greatest pleasure from in the stories that I read. I mean, I didn't grow up reading anything. But when I did finally start reading, 19, I was reading Eudora Welty. I was reading Faulkner. I was reading really great writers who cared immensely about language.
I mean, it's the universal truth. And I think particularly that there's a school of American writing, which is that particular plainness. That is, everything is reduced to an essence, and it is a rhythmic, evocative, illustrative essence. But nonetheless, it is spare.
But you know, if you read a book like Mrs. Dalloway, Mrs. Dalloway is that also. I mean, Mrs. Dalloway is only about 160 pages long, and it's this gigantic book. But it's so measured. It's the words are so chosen. She doesn't put a foot wrong in that book, and so I think it's just more than it is American. It's just partly it's the nature of modernism, but also it's just the nature of the individual.
There's something I read in reading for this, somebody saying that the American novel had somehow escaped modernism, that it was lodged in the 19th century tradition.
What moron would say that?
Might have been a friend of yours, I think. Was it John Banville?
No, Banville didn't say that, did he?
Might have.
Well, I only have two words to say about that, and that is William Faulkner.
You know? Yeah, well, that's a good response.
Yeah. Banville, you know, Banville is such a scamp because he will just say all kinds of stuff that he doesn't necessarily believe just to see what he get a rise out. So he gets a rise out of me, you know, 9,000 miles away.
Yes. Did you...
that's just unbelievable.
Do you consider yourself a modernist?
I just consider myself I'm a hod carrier instead of an architect, you know. That's what I consider myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a guy who puts one brick in the wall after another. That's what I think. And I can, you know, I learned so much when I was young from Donald Barthelme and from William Gass and from all of these postmodernist writers. And what I learned was to what we were just talking about in terms of choosing words and why you choose words and why you do. But the reason I am a writer at all is because of Sherwood Anderson and Frank O'Connor. And so I managed in some way to blend the sort of postmodernist ethic of language being everything with the fundamental traditional nature of Chekhovian storytelling.
A great friend of Raymond Carver's.
My best friend. Absolutely.
And your short fiction has been bracketed a little in that sense of minimalist realism.
But it's been bracketed by people who don't know what they're talking about.
Them again.
Them again. They're everywhere, aren't they? Carver wrote not long stories, but they were as full as he could make them. And when you read a Carver story, you don't get to the end and feel like that you've been cheated out of your lunch. And so I just think it's a term that's borrowed in from other art forms. And it didn't fit Ray, and it doesn't fit me. It certainly doesn't fit me because I write stories that are so much longer than his stories. And I never tried to write stories as short as his stories, though he certainly had a pronounced effect on my decision to try to write stories.
And there's a wonderful, I mean, there is a shared thing in the elevation of the quotidian, you know, of making the banal, which is the sum of most of our lives, a thing of significance and of poetry and beauty.
Sure, but Turgenev had done that already, and Chekhov had done it already, and all kinds of people had done it. He wasn't doing it first, and you know, it's one of the things that literature can do. Literature can say to the reader, "Wait, look at this. You think that wasn't very important, but let me show you because I'm going to make it be important to you." I mean, do you think about Chekhov's great story, The Lady with the Pet Dog? You get to the end of that story, because I remember, I must have read it 30 times in my life, and the first 25 times I read it, I got to the end and I thought, what happened? Did something happen? Everybody says this is a great story. Why? And when I finally grew up to be old enough to understand anything, I thought, oh, I get it. He's drawing our attention to this because he is averring that it is important. And because he is averring that it's important, if he's felicitous enough to get me to here, I'm going to try to figure out why it's important based on what he says.
As Bascom grows older and the arc of those novels, and that in some ways it's this sort of progress through middle America and a middle American man making that progress.
Right.
The place has changed greatly in that time.
Yeah, it has. But you know, and I believe it has. I don't know that I'm the best barometer for the ways in which it has changed, because the ways in which it has changed probably is more the province of a social scientist. Mm-hmm. and a man who or a woman who deals in social scientific generalities, whereas I am wedded to the particular. And you know, in the way that Blake said, you know, if grandeur of ideas is housed in the specificity of ideas, and so my whole remit is details, And at the level of details, I think less has changed. I mean, I started living in New York in 1968 when Christina and I got married, and so I then went for 10 years I taught at Columbia, and the last 10 years. And I couldn't tell any difference in New York at all. It was still hard pavements, taxi cabs, traffic, noise, you know, the smells of the street, which was exactly the way it was when I lived there in 1968. So at the level in which I experience life, on the level of particularity, it's much the same. And for me, that's quite heartening because it allows me, through 50 years of a writing life, to create some sense of a familiar landscape.
You're going to hate the words here, but is that a sign of the privilege of your experience?
Yes, I guess so. It's certainly the nature of my experience, but I'm unabashed about the privilege of my experience. The privilege of my experience is the privilege that my wife and I have given me, and I've tried to make a corresponding use of it.
Basker moves into the Trump era, and he's not impressed. Fair to say, but I think the thing that distinguishes him as an ordinary middle American person is his absence of bitterness, which seems to be the motivating thing in a lot of the current American politics. And yet here is this person of optimism and a sense of happy purpose.
Well, that's his writer's predilection. I mean, that's my predilection. I get to the end of a book or I get to the end of a story, and what I ask myself is, what can I say that will renew this? What words can I find that will renew what I've just asked you to read? I mean, I think that given any crossroads in the life of a story, I will always work away from bitterness. I will always work away from the lesser of the possibilities. I mean, there's a line of Leavis's, of F.R. Leavis. He says that literature is the supreme means by which we renew our sensuous and emotional life and learn a new awareness. And that's for me. I want to redeem the language and want to redeem sensuous and emotional life. And I want to have something to say that will be memorable at the end.
Does that mean then that you've, I mean, there must have been times when you've rejected the turns that some of your stories are taking, that you say, well, no, actually, no, I want that to move into more positive territory.
And I didn't always succeed at that. I mean, there are stories in Rock Springs. Rock Springs has one story called Great Falls, which starts off, this is not a happy story, I warn you. And it comes out to the end to be a rather glum ending at the story. At the end of the story. And so what I think to myself, and I think this about Jim Salter too, who's often writing about people that I don't like, that, you know, if I were to meet them, I'm sure I wouldn't like them. The willingness to entertain these subjects in the best chosen language that I can entertain them, I would have be the redemptive medium in which these things take place. Chosen words.
A great man, Salter.
Salter was a great man, and it was a great. He was also a great guy, and a wonderful writer.
The thing about a character that you would like, I get the feeling that yes, Baskin would be a perfectly likable guy. I get the feeling that Rabbit Engstrom, for example, I think I would hate.
Not so much.
Not a nice person.
I kind of thought the same way, but Updike, you know, Updike just had a. He just had an appetite for people like that. He was a pretty dark little creature.
So how does that sustain? If your argument would be that people would want that sense of elevation and hope, I think, which you kind of don't get from Rabbit, and yet there is this series that still holds people.
Rabbit. You don't get it if you are one of those people, and you are not, obviously, and nor am I. We are not the kind of people who say, oh, I didn't like that book because I didn't like that character. We think to ourselves that a novel is a multifarious offering, and it has all, it's a forgiving form. If one thing's not quite as good as it should be, something else in the novel will help it and supply it some sustenance. And Updike, I think, was such a magisterial writer of sentences that no matter how brutish or unappealing Rabbit might be, what you get are great sentences. And again, I go back to what I said before, that is ultimately where the rubber meets the road for writers, for readers.
You said that Be Mine is the last.
Yes, it is. It's the last of these Bascom books. I would love to be able to write another book. I'm 80, so I don't know, you know. I don't want to be one of those guys who slumps forward on my desk with half of a book written.
Which I'd almost rather write, scandalously would be published without your knowledge.
No, I've got a good, I've got somebody who really out. Does have my back.
I wonder whether it's the last, because I would, don't take this the wrong way.
Oh, that's assured that I will take it the wrong way.
But I would kind of like to see how you wrote Frank Bascom's death.
Well, not in this book.
No.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Not a spoiler.
Well, that's okay. I don't mind spoilers in my books. They're not made that way. You'll have to find other ways to get to the end. But, Jonathan...
Because that's his final... That's an ultimate challenge for his worldview, is it not?
That he... dies?
Well, just said that he might die. This is going to sound crazy. He might die with optimism.
Well, but I can't have him die because I'd have to be writing about him in the first person. So unless it, you know,
there would be a quick
rewrite Sunset Boulevard. I just never thought that I could write him dying, because he would have to be there to narrate it.
You could, in the Updike mode.
Well, but you could turn it into the third person. Yeah. And don't think I haven't thought about that. I've thought about everything. I've thought about changing Frank's race. I've thought about changing Frank's gender. That's wonderful to...
What happens when you think those thoughts? How closely do you think that?
I feel wonderful because what I think is that I'm not trapped by what I have done before. Because that's the real trick. If you're going to write these successive books, they have to, they can't narrow in. They have to push out the sides of what you can do.
Did you ever think that his, you know, in the course of the five books, that his race was run? That
every time, yeah. Every time I got to the end of The Sports Writer, The Lay of the Land, and Infinity, I thought to myself, that's it. I've used up all the material. I'll never do this again, and I've done it as well as I possibly can, and I'll never return to this.
And what changes? What's the...
Well, the allure of the way in which his voice, being both smart and funny on the page, creates an appetite in me to try to negotiate more experience, to push more things through that hopper. To see what I can get him to notice, and see what I can get him to say and think about, feel about experience that I think is worth telling.
So does he have a sense to you of sort of independent perception? Does he?
None. No, he has nothing. Only I have it. I mean, that's what author means. Author means that I authorize everything.
Just so we're clear.
He's not whispering little things in my ear. Sometimes people will ask me, what's Frank doing when you're not around? And I'm just going to say, he's not doing anything.
He's in his box.
He's in his box, just like Charlie McCarthy. That's exactly right.
I read this recently. You thought that Kevin Spacey could...
Oh, yeah.
And I take two things. You could play Bascom, but the later Bascom. I take two things from that. One is that Jimmy Stewart's dead.
Yeah.
And the second is that you don't have much time for the sort of political correctness that might attend casting Spacey in that role.
No, I have no patience with it at all. Not interested in it. I thought for many years I don't know Kevin Spacey, so otherwise I would have long ago tried to buttonhole him to do this. but now... Frank has grown old enough and Kevin Spacey has grown old enough that he's kind of come around on it again, and he could still play Frank if he would. But I don't think he's quite an A-list guy these days.
There's that.
Yeah, there is that. But I just make that separation between whatever kind of guy he is and whatever his genius is in his work. I mean, I'm just not going to cancel Kevin Spacey.
And that culture of some silencing and of caution, I think, is, I suspect, not a thing that you're comfortable with. I mean, and from your writing, I take your position as being a generous, liberal take of the world.
About most things, I think, probably, yeah. You just kind of make yourself up. That's what you do. And I try to do as little harm as I can, but I don't always succeed.
Mm. You a political writer?
I believe that there's the line of George Eliot's in which she says there's no private life that hasn't been previously determined by a larger public life. And so I do think that everything that we do as individuals, I don't mean to say that they're motivated by politics, but they certainly do, everything that we do as individuals radiates out to the larger public sphere. That what politicians are doing on the grander scale, or in my country, not the grand scale, corresponds to something that we're doing on the ground. So it's not hard to imagine what human beings do in the privacy of their houses and privacy of their lives as being correlative to what people are doing on the larger stage.
I mean, there's an argument in BMI, and I think a gentle sense of political argument, and the whole thing of the presidential effigies, the craziness of all of that and what surrounds it is a bit of a rebuke to the grandiosity of some of the politics.
Yep. And also, it's not more in the book because I am not astute enough to put more of it in the book. Plus, I didn't want to have the word Donald Trump in my book any more than I could possibly get away with.
There's a good description of Trump in the book.
There is one,
I have it somewhere. Wait a moment. Well, excuse me while I refer to my notes. Trump. President Trump's swollen eyes, bulging face, doing his pooch-lipped, arms-folded Mussolini.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm just saying what everybody else thinks there. I don't think I'm one of those people who said he would never be elected the first time. So, I mean, if you've gone out on that particular limb, it's been chopped off.
And as a thoughtful American, the prospect of a second time, how does that strike you?
Well, I mean, it would be a disaster, I think. I mean, I think the world thinks it would be a disaster. I was saying to somebody yesterday, I've been in Australia and in New Zealand for the last few days, and I get embarrassed when people start talking to me about our political dilemma in the United States. And one of the ways in which people talk to me about it is to talk about the way in which the model that America has been for some people's sense of Republican rectitude and an aspiring place with a lot of warts and darknesses too. And I'm embarrassed because Americans don't pay any attention to that I would say, by and large. Americans don't think that the sphere of influence which we have had for a long time is being hugely diminished. And so when I hear people talking about that, I think to myself, oh, Christ, if Americans could just understand what it is that other countries and other populations have thought about us in the past, even with slavery, even with all kinds of darknesses in our history. But unfortunately, Americans don't look outside our boundaries for the corroborative support that we should look to.
Do you feel tempted to write about that sort of thing directly? I remember you wrote a beautiful and moving piece immediately after 9/11.
Yes.
Which sort of, cut to the core of a very intensely political moment, I guess, in its way.
I was just lucky there, you know. Somebody called me up from the New York Times and said, would you write about 9/11? I thought, well, Christ, yes. I am a writer, so I will do that. Mm. And I just hit a lucky tangent in a way, you know, thinking about all these people who died in those in that day, not being able to be honored at their death in the way that my father was, for instance. But do I think about writing about that? Sure, I think if I felt like I could invent something that would be worth saying or reading, I would try to do that.
It perhaps hasn't got to that point of extremity that 9/11 had for you, that it was became an act of necessity, I suppose.
Yes, it was. It was. And we were all, of course, as the world was, we were all hugely affected by that.
You mentioned your father, and of course he died when you were quite young.
16. Mm. I was 16 when he died. Yeah, he died in my arms. Yeah. Yeah, in his bed. Yeah. He had a heart attack. I just woke up one morning, on a Saturday morning, and I could hear him gasping for breath in the room that he slept in. I just went in to see what was going on, and he was indeed expiring. Yeah.
How does that wash through the years? Has that become something of a gift to being able to share that moment with him?
I never thought about that, Jonathan. I always felt after that took place, I'm not much for feeling guilt about anything. But I felt that there was something wrong with me after he died because I didn't cry. And in a way, I couldn't cry really because my mother was hysterical. But I later came to understand that his death meant that nobody was looking after me anymore, really, as they had, and that I was free to do things more than I would have been free had he lived. I mean, the worst thing about my father's death was that he died, that his life ended. But the effect that it had on me was quite complicated.
I can feel its proximity to you. You say that you're a sort of person who constantly relives every detail of their life.
Every day.
Every day.
Yeah, I do.
It's a crowded space.
I've got nothing else to do, though. Isn't that the truth? I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I sort of think that I do, in a 24-hour span of time, think about everything I've ever done. I mean, maybe it's just the habit of a lifetime of doing what I have done, being a writer, and it seems interesting. And I'm always a little sorry when I can't remember something or I can't dream something up. When I feel like I've missed something if I can't think about it.
Is it triggered or is it just a routine flicking through the file?
I don't know. I don't know the difference between instinct and habit. I don't know. It feels like it's natural to me, though, to do that. Maybe it's an only child thing. I don't know. It's only child's great.
On that note, I think I might hand this over to you. I'm sure you have questions. Do you think they have questions? Here we go.
Please, sir.
It's really interesting. I discovered you when I was 19. You've had a profound effect on my own writing and becoming a novelist.
Oh,
and
good. I'm happy that can be true.
Yeah, I very much appreciate it. But I guess what's interesting to me is hearing you talk about when you were writing The Sports Writer. For me, you are inevitable, right? Like I found you, Rock Springs, Sports Writer, and then when Independence Day happened, it was just like, wow, like Pulitzer Prize, we're here. And that was before I truly understood what that could mean, but I just knew, oh, this guy who writes these books got this huge thing. But I just wonder, like hearing you talk about it, just within that sense of it not being inevitable, could you talk about what the response to The Sports Writer meant to you, and then also, I don't want to say impossibility, but just the shock or whatever you felt about Independence Day winning the Pulitzer Prize and where that then positioned you going forward?
Well, I think both of those pieces of good fortune made me feel merely and importantly encouraged. It made me feel that maybe I could really do this. Maybe I wasn't bad at it. And I think that's probably the most important thing that I thought. I've always thought that I wasn't cut out to be a writer, and that I sort of made myself be a writer. And I carry it with me all the time, a sort of profound sense of doubt that I can do this thing, whatever it is. And so when I won those prizes or the books did well, when they did, for a brief period, I thought, well, maybe you can do this again. Maybe it makes sense to try to write another book, and maybe you can get better at it, because I'm very big about getting better. So I thought I could get better at it. When the sports writer had a good life. But you know, it's a funny thing about the sports writer. Sports writer didn't get all good reviews. It was at a time in my life when I still read reviews. There were plenty of kicks in the ass that I got when the sports writers played. But one remembers that book now, and I try to remember it that way myself. As being, you know, a really successful book. And for me, it was. It sold a lot of copies, and it still goes on selling lots of copies, and people read it. So that's all I cared about. The bad reviews, I ultimately, after grinding my teeth, got over. But thank you.
I was rereading The Sports Writer a few months ago. I really enjoyed the book.
Oh, good. I'm glad it can be alive again.
Yeah. And it just suddenly struck me how much detail is in it, in so far as what Frank notices, I suppose, is what it comes down to.
Yes.
Had a quick look before I came out here and just noticed that when, in those very early pages, he's in the cemetery, I think, waiting for his wife, and he notices the sounds of the birds, and there's a bit of a detail there, and then I think a deer or a rabbit, and then there's the neighbours playing next door, the sounds of them playing tennis. The question is, how much conscious work do you put into creating scenes as detailed as that, or does it just come naturally to you, or do you think, oh, I need to think about what Frank would be experiencing in this situation, I probably need these three things to make it all work for the reader? Could you just talk a little bit about your process there?
It does not come natural to me. I think my wife would argue with me about that, but I don't think it comes natural to me. Putting all those details into books means that I'm for each of those details there is a word, and so I'm trying to put words into books. Try to get the best words I can, and words have all of these, as we said before, non-cognitive qualities. They have an auditory quality, they have a synesthetic quality, they have all kinds of qualities that they bring to the page, and if I can find words that bring all of that synesthesia to the page, then what I've done is created a background against which what the characters are doing in the foreground can be made to seem more plausible. So in other words, I think it's pleasurable to hear those sounds through words on the page. But I'm basically subordinating those things in my mind to what the characters are doing in the foreground. But to get all that stuff onto the page, it's just, you know, it just requires doing it and believing that doing it is valuable. But I don't think it really comes all that natural to me, but I thought, okay, if you're going to be a novelist, you know, there's a way in which you can think that fiction is about making people real to themselves, and if I can write a book that is rich enough to make you think this is what life is, even if I'm not noticing all of it in my everyday life, then I have succeeded in making people real, their lives real to themselves.
That, sadly, is the end of our time, but a rather nice round note on which to end.
Thank you.
Well, I think we should thank you. And put your hands together for Richard Ford.
You've been listening to Jonathan Green in conversation with Richard Ford. It was recorded on Tuesday, the 27th of February 2024 at the Wheeler Centre. The bookseller for this event was Mary Martin Bookshop. The Wheeler Centre podcast is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. You can listen to more podcasts or explore videos, news, and our full calendar of events at wheelercentre.com.